This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to the June 7th, 2021 For Your Benefit radio show. We're here today to talk about taxes. And who to better to talk about taxes than Dave DeJong and Steve Wittes, both attorneys at law and also tax experts. So grab your paper, grab your pencil, and this will all be understandable, but that's what we're going to talk about today. So guys, we talked before getting on air where we should start. So I think the understanding was we were going to talk about the SECURE Act initially and make sure everybody's got a handle on that and then go into others. Am I right with that?
That's right. Good morning, Bob. Dave and I thought it best to start there because while we're going to talk about a lot of the new provisions that have been proposed, it's been about a year and a half since the SECURE Act came in. And while many of the enactments were thought to be tax reduction, the SECURE Act is actually one that's pretty heavy. What it effectively does is it says that for qualified retirement plans, IRAs, when somebody dies and they leave it to somebody other than a spouse, with very few exceptions, the distributions, rather than the prior law, which permitted a payout over the recipient's lifetime, it's now limited to 10 years. Those 10 years, needless to say, shorten up the payout period by quite a bit, and the taxes can be pretty heavy. So there's been some different planning tools used, but it is something that especially the folks that I think are listening to this program need to be aware of and to do as part of their planning, that that 10 years is a short payout period. I believe it can be done in any manner over the 10-year period. So rather than taking it out ratable, it can be taken out over any time over the 10-year period.
How did your clients handle this?
Well, I found that they were a little bit freaked out because more and more of our clients had payouts that would go into a trust for children for a long term. They were worried about children getting divorced or asset protection. But when we said, well, if it's a payout period, you wanted everything what goes into the trust then comes out, they've made adjustments. So they said, even if they're higher taxes, we think we want some of those payouts to stay in the trust, even if they're taxed at a quicker period. So rather than in and out, they actually would stay in there for a longer time and accumulate.
You both speak, I would say quarterly, not so much recently, and you would give a tax presentation to, if you will, tax professionals, accountants, attorneys, etc. Of that group, do you find that they had a hard time with what we're just talked about, plus what we're going to talk about afterwards?
I think there was a lot of ambiguity in the beginning. As Steve noted, you apparently have 10 years in which to take all funds out of the retirement plan following the death of the employee or account holder, and you apparently do not need to take distributions during this period of time, but for the first 15 months or so after enactment, there appeared to be a lot of confusion. The law was not really written clearly, and the IRS has some published materials that are not correct.
And what also came about, to add on to something Dave noted, is the fact that I think Roth IRAs have actually become more popular in the sense that if, as we believe is correct, that, for example, somebody could die and essentially have a payout, it ends up being 10 and a half years. Let's say somebody died now. If there was a Roth that didn't have to be taken out, So for 10 and a half years, it can accumulate tax-free and then start actually coming out to the non-spouse beneficiaries. That can be a very powerful tool. And that's the way we believe it would work rather than a required ratable per year distribution.
So when you talk about the focus then on a non-spouse being the recipient, does the spouse take exception to that? This makes good economic sense and good tax sense, but somebody says, well, I like cash sense.
The spousal rules are unchanged from prior law, which means in most cases, especially where the surviving spouse was the younger of the two, that it makes sense for the survivor to roll over into an account in his or her name. There will be a rare instance, most commonly, where it is the younger spouse who died first, where it may make sense not to roll it over and to keep it as a decedent account, in which case distributions do not need to begin tied to the age of the transferee, but tied to the age of the original account holder who was younger. You would not need to take until that person reached age 72. So there's a lot of planning opportunities for surviving spouses, but the norm will be a rollover into the name of the surviving spouse.
And one other aspect that we've noted is if the decedent dies and does leave it to a non-spouse, let's say to two children who are in their 30s, one of their first concerns is, oh my God, are we going to have a 10% penalty because we haven't reached age 59 and a half? This is an exception to it. If somebody receives kind of what's called an inherited IRA, there is no 10% penalty on those withdrawals.
I bet they're happy when they hear that, not the circumstance caused one person to pass, but it's nice to know, and I'm not so sure everybody understands that or even knows that.
Well, the other thing that I find is a misconception is that people said, well, you know, Dad had this great, all these wonderful tech stocks in his IRA. So, boy, we're going to have, you know, and Dave will address this more, but this will all be taxed at capital gains, right? Because it was stocks. Said, no, no, no. Whatever comes out of an IRA or qualified plan, with very few exceptions, is hardcore ordinary income tax rates, taxed really at a very high rate.
I'm dealing with people on the tax prep side all my life. I'm always surprised that people really don't understand what a tax bracket is. And without boring everyone, but the usual question is, my friend got a raise and they put him into a higher tax bracket and they lost money. And I try to explain it's numerically impossible. Other than some exceptional things, I said you just pay tax at the higher level at the federal, probably not too much of a difference on the state, but it's only on the money that gets up into that higher bracket. Am I right with that?
Yeah, and that's where the term marginal tax bracket comes from. It's the next dollar of income. What bracket will it be taxed in? And today, our highest tax bracket is 37%. There's an alternative term called effective. When you take all of your income and you compute the total taxes that you paid and you put the two numbers together, you've determined your effective tax bracket. But we work more commonly with marginal. That means if you make an extra dollar, how much will you lose in taxes. But as you noted, Bob, it's still better to make a dollar than not make that dollar.
Yeah, I've offered many times for people to give me the money and they could claim it as a gift, and no takers, plus I'd lose my license. But but then they get it. So if we're okay with the tax rates, we've talked about, I think Dave used the term regular tax rate, but then there are other tax rates. One of them, we call them capital gains tax rates, correct? And those are generally less than what the other rates are. But
under current law, that is, in fact, the case. And the highest capital gain rate today for most assets is 20%. But in some cases, there is an add-on Medicare tax as well that will add 2.9% on to the 20%. The two major exceptions are when you dispose of real estate that you've taken depreciation on, then you are going to be taxed at 25% instead of at 15 or 20%, plus that Medicare tax. And collectibles, you sell off a coin collection or an art collection, then your rate is 28% plus the Medicare tax. And of course, if you have not held the asset for at least a year and a day, you're taxed at ordinary income rates. Now, there is a proposal that won't affect a lot of people, but part of the most recent Biden proposal is to tax those who have seven-figure incomes and above on their capital gains at ordinary income rates, which under the Biden proposal would go up from 37% to 39.6%. Interestingly, if you follow tax history like I do, when there's a change in administration, that highest rate fluctuates. The 39.6% highest rate came in during the administration of Bill Clinton. It went back to 37% during the administration of George W. Bush, to 39.6% during the Obama administration, then back to 37% during the Trump administration. So each time there's been a change in political parties going back now 30 years, that top rate has gone up or down.
Isn't there another factor too, Dave, that, and Bob, that a lot of people say, well, gee, if I sell this asset, I only have to pay 20%. But if you add in, you know, essentially the other 3% for Medicare, and let's say Maryland, it's close to 9%, I believe, you're actually getting taxed at pretty much about a third, you know, of that gain. It's not the whole thing. It's only the gain that's vulnerable, but it is generally more than 20%. And I realize, you know, Florida, Texas, certain other states have exceptions to that. But most states, you can't forget about the state impact either.
All righty. And we can't forget about our sponsors. So why don't we take a short break and we'll listen to what WEPA can do for the listeners.
Never underestimate your needs when purchasing life insurance. There are important factors to keep in mind, like future expenses and lifetime economic value. WAPA not only offers group term life insurance for civilian federal employees, but walks you through the important questions you need to ask yourself while reviewing your policy options. Life insurance is a conversation worth having. Why not have it with WAPA? Serving civilian feds and their families since 1943. Visit WAEPA.org today.
Life can be unpredictable. Stay prepared with coverage from WAPA. Civilian feds can apply for up to $1.5 million in life insurance regardless of their salary. Explore new products including group short-term disability insurance, where you can apply for benefits up to $6,500 a month to replace income while recovering from a covered short-term disability. WAPA will help shape your policy to meet your changing needs. Visit WAEPA.org today for coverage exclusively for feds by feds.
Welcome back to the June 7th, 2021 For Your Benefit radio show. We're here with David DeJong and Steve Wittes, and we're talking about taxes. Both Dave and Steve are attorneys with the firm Stein Sperling Bennett DeJong Driscoll. How'd you get DeJong in there? So anyway, we hit ordinary tax rates. I would say, is there anything that we didn't talk about with regards to that that maybe the listeners would say, yeah, I you didn't talk about that? And you both are looking at me like...
a couple of loose ends, Bob. There is always a change in the retirement plan area, and we've got a couple of ones pending, so I don't think our discussion of the SECURE Act, which did have a beneficial position in that minimum distributions do not need to be taken now until age 72. Instead of the old 70 and a half, there is a proposal pending that would change that to 75. And of course, if you are still working, you do not need to take distributions from your employer's plan until you retire. That does not apply to IRAs. And there's also some talk of allowing an emergency borrowing from your 401k of up to $1,000 each year. So there's always something pending. Note that these two potential changes are not law yet.
A good point there, but with regards to your clients, maybe clients that have been with you for a while or new clients that are attracted, do you find that anybody comes in with a good grasp of what you just said?
Now, it is very, very tough, and there's been some calls for simplification of the retirement plan laws, but it isn't just the rules on distributions that are very difficult for small and mid-sized businesses as well as individuals. It is the rules on contributions as well. So people do come in with lots of questions and some misconceptions about the retirement plan laws.
There's a term called built-in gains tax. I mean, that sounds almost like it was hidden until somebody opened up the right box. What is a built-in gains tax?
Bob? Dave, do you want to address the built-in gains tax? Did you hear that, Dave, that he wants to know about the built-in gains tax? Oh, do you mean the new law that's been proposed, Bob?
Yes.
Is that what you're...
Mm-hmm.
All right. So traditionally, there's been an emphasis, and from our perspective, more and more clients have been coming to us saying, gee, we hear that the estate tax exemption might go down, but traditionally one of the, and it's putting it crudely, but one good thing about dying is that if you have appreciated assets that aren't in like a qualified plan or IRA, let's say you own stock that you bought for $10,000, it was worth $100,000 at the time of death, they have what's called step up in basis, meaning that $90,000 inherent gain essentially goes away when you leave it to the next generation or spouse or whoever. If it was the same that you had gifted it to somebody, that's called carryover basis. They have the same income tax basis, and basis what is what you take away from the sales price to determine the gain. So if there was sort of that built-in gain that in theory was protected when you die, and again, not to retirement plans or insurance premiums or things that were never taxed, but basically, essentially that was protected and people just had to worry about the estate tax. The government is actually proposing to not only change that, but to do it in a couple ways. They almost are going to like a Canadian kind of system in which at the time of death, subject to certain protective quantitative amounts, it would essentially accelerate the income, the built-in gains, almost in lieu of an estate tax. And while last year there was a big concern about the estate tax, the general approach to the administrative proposals this year seem to be have a real emphasis on the income tax side. Do we tax that? When Bernie Sanders introduced something, I think it's called the 99.5% Act, whatever it is, that was more of an emphasis on estate taxes. But several senators have introduced one that would try to tax the built-in gains at possibly when there's a large gift or at death. And as Dave noted, even maybe for some very wealthy people, even without that. But it's become a major topic of conversation and the possibility that we thought this was protected. The other issue is that if somebody dies and we don't have a step up in basis, if they simply say, well, we're not going to tax it, but you get essentially carryover basis at death, it would be a nightmare to trace that. Because if you got stock from your great-grandfather or something, how do you know what your basis is when he died, whatever?
So if you've faced this conundrum, if you will, but there was also an IRS agent looking over your shoulder, and you said, this is what I feel the basis is, and here's X, Y, and Z, have you found their response?
This is one of the major issues with this proposal, that when you do not get a step up in the tax basis at death, and you've had property in the family for multiple generations, that you have to go back and prove, and the burden of proof is really on the taxpayer to show what they paid for it, what they put in the property in the way of improvements. Was there a step up in basis in the past that might have helped, or a partial step up if one of the spouses died? That has been the biggest problem associated with a gifting under current law, where you do not get a step up in basis, unlike death. So it appears that this will be a problem. And as Steve noted, it'll be less of a problem if we go to the system that exists in Canada with a tax on death that is tied to the rise in value or upon making a gift. But the current proposal is a $1 million exemption at death from the immediate tax, or a $100,000 exemption in the case of gifts. So especially in the latter, it's going to be real difficult to come up with basis information that is old.
So I think, Dave and Bob, I think, wasn't it the 76 Tax Reform Act that tried to do this?
Yeah.
I'd like to say, I was a youngster at that point, but I wasn't. But they tried, and it would turn out to be a nightmare. Eventually, they took the fact that this carryover basis and the non-step up provisions were reinstated. But trying to figure out, like Dave and I have noted, that how do you go back in time? And also, I found that with all the stock brokerages and all the various companies that have bought out others, that, you know, how do you figure out how you can trace this and get real numbers? And you're right, the IRS said it's on you. The assumption is not with the taxpayer.
How about this? There's something called a like-kind exchange, and I believe it's sometimes more associated with real estate, but not 100% of the time. But as I'm listening to you and the folks that are listening to this show, they go, is there a way to reduce the tax doing a like-kind exchange? First of all, what's a like-kind exchange?
A like-kind exchange is a swap, in essence, often done in steps of property. Now, you used to be able to do it in regard to personal property. Now it's limited to real estate, and the real estate that is disposed of and acquired must, in each case, either be for investment or rental. If you are a developer and you're holding property for resale, that's not eligible for a swap. But if you've had a rental house and you no longer want that property and you're ready to cash in and there is a lot of gain on it, you can typically, through what we call a Starker exchange, after an old court case, you use an escrow agent to hold the funds on the sale of your original property, and then you have a short period in which to designate the replacement property and 180 days to go to closing on it. It has been very popular, particularly for middle and upper middle income individuals who've chosen to invest in real estate. The latest Biden proposal would limit the amount of gain that you can defer to $500,000, which will be sufficient on exchanges of most single family properties, condominiums, but in the cases of upper income people dealing in homes in higher brackets, or others who hold apartment buildings or shopping centers or similar, the Biden proposal would virtually eliminate the tax benefit.
So two other pieces of that are that, number one, as Dave noted, that's for investment or rental. We've had people that said, well, couldn't I just do that with my home? Not really. It can't be just personal property. And number two, we had a relative who dealt with violins, you know, very fancy violins. And it was pretty common in the practice to, you know, sell one and replace it under the rules Dave noted. And a few years ago, that was changed just to real estate. So this is maybe a further cutback on it if this passes through.
So how about this? Let's say an individual or a couple have a home that's the quote residence, but they also have a second home. And that second home was really nice at the time, but development isn't what was anticipated. Could they sell that property? Again, this is a normal property, and do what's called a tax-free exchange and then buy another one or buy two more? There's some kind of rule.
They would need, Bob, to convert the second home for a period of time to rental property before they could do a swap. Second homes get the worst possible tax treatment, because if it's your primary residence, depending on your marital status, you have an exclusion of either $250,000 or $500,000 in gain. If it is, in fact, investment property.
Okay. And people in my world, dealing with tax returns, it just seems to be a fair number of people have this second residence, or they have or a piece of dirt, if you will, ground, and they are unaware of a tax-free exchange to exchange this property for another one, but it's just not property for property. Let's say the property had no building on it. It was just raw ground. Could they exchange that for another piece of property, but it's not raw ground, it's got a building on it? Would that be a like kind?
I came back on after losing my signal, so I didn't hear the full question. Steve, can you answer it? Otherwise, it'll need to be repeated.
Right. Dave, I think the question is, and Bob, I lost a little bit of this. Sorry, I've got an echo in my head. But I think it was if there was raw land in exchange for a building, is that permissible as a like-kind exchange, even there wasn't an actual building on the initial property? I think, Bob, you meant this isn't a second home. This is actually investment property, though, right?
Right.
Yeah, you can swap raw land, which is generally investment property, for property that has an apartment or a house or similar on it. So there's no issue there. The issues arise when it is a personal residence or if it is being held for development or speculation.
Okay, good. Let's take a short question, and then we'll take a break. I don't know how short this is going to be. Corporations, as I understand it, come in two tax-flavored. Corporate tax and or an individual capital gains tax. Is the corporate tax going to go up? I see something mentioned here, an increase of 25% to 28% is possible, as well as a minimum tax of 15%. So what does somebody need to be aware of before they sell that property?
The original Biden proposal called for a corporate tax rate of 28% instead of the current 21%. But we have seen pressure from the other industrialized nations, given our global economy, to keep the corporate tax rate low. And the emphasis may be turning away from the corporate tax rate in general to a minimum tax to make sure that all corporations pay at least 15%, irrespective of whether the U.S. operations, as opposed to their worldwide operations, are profitable. Now, in terms of small business, C corporations have been fallen out of favor since the late 1980s. With the lower tax rate, they become more popular for those people that want to leave income in their business. But if the corporate rates go back up, we will return to the past, with it being only a rare case where it makes sense to be, for small and mid-sized businesses, to be C corporations. LLCs remain the entity of choice for most.
All righty. Well, now it's time for the second break, and we'll let the folks listen to what NITP can do.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're in the final leg of today's discussion. We're with Dave DeJong and Steve Wittes, both attorneys and both with the law firm Stein Sperling, Bennett DeJong and Driscoll. And we talked a fair amount about investments, and we talked about business. Under another discussion item, what about the child tax credit or a child credit? Dependent care credit, these would be things that most anybody would be interested in knowing about, or they don't want to hear it if the income is too high. So what did they do there? What did Congress do with this?
Well, there was a one-year legislation that was enacted in the first month or 6 weeks of the Biden administration that modified all three of these benefits. Very briefly, it increased the child credit that those families get who are raising one or more children historically under the age of 17. And this did not apply to those who are considered upper middle income. It phases out at $75,000 for single individuals and $150,000 for married couples. But the amount of the credit, if you're eligible, multiplied by the number of kids, was a big benefit to middle income and lower middle income individuals who were struggling. And the proposals of the administration would extend this provision and one dealing with the earned income credit and the dependent care credit. It would expand, it would keep the expansion of these credits in place for an additional period. Some of the provisions would be made so-called permanent, although nothing is truly permanent in the tax law, and others would expand it for several years. In the earned income credit, that particularly benefits those with the lowest income, it would increase the maximum credit significantly, And in the case of the dependent care credit, it would enlarge the qualifying expenses and increase the credit. So there is a focus in the Biden bill on those who are particularly struggling with their income levels.
Okay, state and local tax deductions with regards to a personal tax return. There was a change, five or six years ago, where it capped total of $10,000 that would include state and local income tax as a deduction, real estate tax, personal property tax, et cetera. Am I right with that?
And yeah, that came in 2018, enacted with the legislation in the first year of the Trump administration. And much to the dismay of individuals who are middle income, upper income in high taxing states, it limited the deduction for state taxes, including income taxes and property taxes, to $10,000, particularly the delegations from states like New York, New Jersey, and California were up in arms, and even a number of Republicans were critical of the provision, but it did get enacted. There was sufficient Republican control. And one of the problems that the president is going to have in getting tax legislation enacted is there are some Democrats in particular from these states that are insisting that the $10,000 cap either go or be increased as part of any tax reform bill. And given the Democrats' narrow majority in both houses, any resistance will either mean that the modification will need to occur or we won't get a tax bill. And that, in fact, is quite uncertain at this point.
Wow. It's another question, a parallel universe, estate tax. There's an estate tax exemption, meaning that if your estate isn't valued at more than X, there'd be an exemption from the estate tax. Do you have a feel for what the current administration wants to leave it the same, wants to change it?
So, Bob, that's very much up in arms. The current amount, which seems very large to most people, of 11.7 million at the federal level, and then obviously depending on the state for the applicable impact there. But it was thought that when this administration came in, there were a lot of proposals to drop it down to, let's say, 3.5 million. So many people thought it best, some wealthy clients, to go ahead and make large transfers to essentially, you know, kind of take advantage of that major difference. There's also, and a third factor is that it is likely that by 2026, so what, 4.5 years from now, that it is very likely that the estate tax exemption will drop down to about 6.5 million. It's 5 million with lots of CPIs and COLAs, et cetera. But and while that seems like a very large amount, that includes life insurance. The estate tax is very different than the probate estate. So it could be retirement plans, homes, businesses, you name it. So there's a thinking that that's up in the air. But the other factor, as we noted before, is the trend seems to be in most of the recent bills that have been introduced is to focus more on the income tax side, such as that built-in gain. Dave mentioned some of the exceptions, about $100,000 for gifts or $1 million on death. But the idea that seems to be the trend, or at least the direction, is that the income tax, and it will be more of the trend and where it'll be more attacked. And there's several senators that have introduced a bill to that that traditionally haven't gotten very involved with tax legislation that seem to carry quite a bit of clout and have some emphasis on that now. So again, it's a little bit up in the air. We're trying to tell clients you need to keep things flexible. Don't commit too much, but some are really wanting to make these transfers soon.
All right. Before we run out of time, which I'm often accused of because it's so captivating what people are talking about, here's a question. How does somebody contact you? Is there a phone number or a website with regards to Stein Sperling?
We can be reached at www.steinsperling.com, and Steve and I can both be reached at 301-340-2020.
And our firm is blessed with a wide range of attorneys, like a lot of firms are. So while Dave and I are invested, you know, doing primarily tax and estate planning, we have lots of other attorneys that cover many, many other areas and, you know, are terrific attorneys. Very pleased to be there.
Okay. So with regards to trusts, people talk about trusts, and there's a GRAT, there's an IDG trust, a lifetime, et cetera. First of all, what is a trust? And second, if I'm trust shopping, what am I looking for?
Well, first of all, that and that question comes up a lot. It's like people that said, I know I'm supposed to avoid probate. And when I ask if they know what that means, they said, not a clue. I just know I need to avoid it. But similarly with the trust, it normally means that someone puts assets, this person being the one who contributes it, called generally a settlor, grantor, trustor, something like that. But they place it in the capacity and holding by a fiduciary called a trustee for the benefit of a third person, or it could be that person. The two main types of trusts are either revocable, with a capital R, or irrevocable, capital I. But a lot of estate planning gets done with it. Traditionally, the revocable trust is used primarily to minimize the costs and delays of probate and is essentially a will substitute. And an irrevocable trust tends to be meaning for protecting someone's assets, tax planning. Could be, some people have even used it for going offshore, which gets a little complicated. But it is usually providing a level of protection for people, either it can be tax or non-tax considerations.
Okay, here's another one. Federal regulation of tax preparers. It's talked about, never seems to go to the finish line. It gets closer and whatnot. But one, do you think that will come soon? And two, if it does, what design do they have, or do they have yet to announce the design of it? What would they be looking for to regulate?
In the 1976 tax legislation brought about the first preparer penalties on the civil side. I don't see this taking off too much, too high, so to speak, simply because there are individuals in Congress who oppose any more governmental regulation. So I think it's going to stay in the talking stages as it has for the last 45 years. What is coming is more enforcement. The IRS has 2/3 of the individuals that it had a generation ago. And there is a belief, although it is opposed by some on Capitol Hill, there is a belief that if more people are hired to audit returns and to collect unpaid taxes, that the gap between what should be paid and what is actually paid will go down. So I do expect there are going to be more IRS agents hired, but I do not see the federal registration of tax preparers coming about.
Well, Dave, I had read somewhere that the agency, the IRS, has lost 15,000 enforcement personnel since 2010. Just to quantify that number, I was surprised it was that many, but it goes along with what you're knowing.
Okay, let's say I needed help with this. What's your contact points? We've talked a lot, and I think we mentioned at one point, but this is a great time towards the end to put it out there again.
Our address on the email is www.steinsperling.com, and our phone number is 301-340-2020.
All righty. Now we have all of what, 2 minutes left? Andrew says 2 minutes. I thought it was a victory sign. He's saying 2 minutes. So final thoughts.
Well, right now it seems to me, Bob, that one of the things that is, and I'm wondering if from the other side and from like the planner side, that what Dave and I do, it almost feels like, not that the carpet's being pulled off from under us, but it is very difficult to plan right now. So as we noted earlier, one has to keep things very flexible. But when clients are saying, what they look at one bill and there's so many that have been introduced, which one do you emphasize? Which one do you rely on?
Okay, we have less than a minute.
And regardless of your politics, I think that you would agree that the changes in the tax law, which generally promote public policy, are what makes the tax law so complex. It's good for people like Steve and me, but I think it hurts the public at large with changes every year in the tax law. And this has really been the case now for about 45 years.
Thanks, Dave. I think we're going to cut that out and put it at the beginning of the show. Anyway, thanks, guys. Another terrific show. Andrew, thanks for watching over us. And listeners, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.